You are listening to Aloud, a program of the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. Visit us at lfla.org.
Good evening. Good evening, and welcome to Aloud. I'm Jessica Strand. I'm the Director of Public Programs here at the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. The Library Foundation of Los Angeles is instrumental in supporting many programs at the Los Angeles Public Library. From homework help to college prep to Read Baby Read, the list is long and the programs are crucial in giving access and assistance to Angelenos across this vast city. This season, we've been focusing on resilience. We picked this idea for many reasons. Most importantly, it spoke to how we had to be and continue to be in the face of COVID. For the last 20 months, we've adjusted our daily lives in order to deal with the constant challenges, frustrations, and acute realities that we've had to face. We kept our families and friends in our hearts and as close as conditions would allow. We gathered for birthdays and baby showers and memorials over Zoom, not able to celebrate or commiserate together, not being able to express face-to-face our collective fear or our personal tragedies. One of the things that keeps us together as a community, and is community. And with community, whether it be your neighborhood or your close friends or your family, food is always a part of the equation. It's been hard to gather during these times, but it's not been hard to cook. And if it has meant even cooking for oneself. During this time, people have learned how to bake bread by the thousands and probably taught themselves cuisines that they never attempted before. Tonight, as we reflect on the past year, we'll talk about how food has brought us strength in the face of adversity. How cooking and sharing a meal, whether over Zoom, is an act of resilience, a promise of being together. Without cookbooks, where would recipes be easily shared with the larger public? It is through them that we are able to understand and pass on rituals and traditions from cultures that are not our own. In this conversation, curated by editor, writer, and food aficionado, Leslie Jonath, Leslie will speak to three prominent California-based cookbook authors who will share their diverse stories about their food traditions and cultural histories as reflected in their recipes and in their books. Leslie Jonath has over 20 years of experience in book publishing, whether it be packaging, editing, or writing lifestyle books. Before creating her own company, Leslie was the director of creative services at Chronicle Books, where she edited and produced over 400 books, including The Pleasure of Slow Food with Corby Gummer, Edible Education with Alice Waters, as well as numerous other books on food and culture. On her own, she's created many beautiful books, including Feed Your People, a book containing 65 big batch recipes from some of the most celebrated chefs in the world. I'm very proud to introduce you to Leslie Jonath. Welcome, Leslie.
Thanks so much, Jessica. And thank you for that wonderful introduction. I'm really excited to host this panel. As Jessica says, food connects us to our past, our family, our communities, and each other. When we feed people, we feed ourselves. I'm delighted to welcome three deeply accomplished storytellers who write about culture and food. Because each one of these authors is so accomplished, I'm going to read their bios. There's just so much to say. Also, because I might get a little emotional, because I really love these people. First, I'd like to start with Bryant Terry. Author, publisher Bryant Terry is a James Beard and NAACP Image Award-winning chef, educator, and author. He has been the chef in residence at the Museum of the African Diaspora, MOAD, in San Francisco, where he creates public programming at the intersection of food, farming, activism, art, culture, and the African diaspora. He's the author of 5 books, including The Inspired Vegan, Vegan Soul Kitchen, Afro-Vegan, and Vegetable Kingdom. In his most recent book, Black Food, Bryant explores Black foodways within America and around the world. In it, Bryant curates a collage of essays, art, music, poetry, and recipes by 100 contributors, with chapters that span spirit, spirituality, leisure, lifestyle, Black future, and more. It is a beautiful, beautiful book. Bryant is now editor-in-chief of Four Colored Books, an imprint of 10 Speed Press, which is dedicated to publishing people of diverse communities. Welcome, Bryant. Also joining us is Naz Devarian. She's the author of Bottom of the Pot, Persian Recipes and Stories, for which she received an IACP Julia First Cookbook Award, and also the coveted Piglet Award, which is now defunct, but it was Food 52's wonderful cookbook award program. About her book, Fine Cooking editor Kimberly Massabee wrote, Devarian's debut book is a tour de force. The 100+ recipes she shares, plus the lovely essays, reminiscences, and photographs serve as proof that a magnificent cookbook, like an excellent meal, is so much more than the sum of its parts. Naz is a contributor to the New York Times food section and has also been published in the Washington Post, the Atlantic, the Los Angeles Times, and the San Francisco Chronicle, among others. In 2020, she was featured in Padma Lakshmi's show, Taste the Nation. She was born in Iran, grew up in Canada, and now lives in Los Angeles with her husband and two children. Welcome, Naz. And finally, we have Andrea Nguyen. Andrea is the author of 6 books on Asian cooking, including Into the Vietnamese Kitchen, Asian Dumplings, The Banh Mi Handbook, and The Faux Cookbook, for which she won a James Beard Award. She's appeared on both local and national television programs and has been interviewed on many radio programs, including NPR's Splendid Table, Martha Stewart Living's Everyday Food, and KCRW, your home radio station, Good Food. A guest speaker at food events, she's also been featured at the Culinary Institute of America's World of Flavors Conference, among others. Her most recent cookbook, Vietnamese Food Any Day, was spotlighted by the New York Times as one of the best cookbooks of 2019. In this book, she makes Vietnamese cooking accessible to all using ingredients found in your grocery store, so you can make it anytime you want. I can tell you that my mother has this book and I had to steal it from her, and it's just covered with splatters of all kinds of things. So it's a very heavily used book in my kitchen and my family kitchen. So I want to thank you all for being here today. And I'm really excited to plunge into this conversation about food and culture. As someone once said, everything in American cuisine today is because of all the different people and cultures. Today, I'd like to talk about how diverse food traditions are foundational to our personal and collective histories and are emblematic of how we adapt to a changing world. So I'd like to kick off the conversation to talking about your more personal stories. Was there someone in your family that cooked for you? I'd love to find out a little bit more about what food memories you have that offer the most strongest personal connection to your family traditions. So Naz, let's start with you. Do you have an answer for that one?
I have a very long answer to that one, but hi. First of all, thank you so much for having me, Leslie, and the Library Foundation. It's an honor to be here with Andrea and Bryant. Thank you for having me. I think for all three of us, specifically for myself, with Iranian cuisine, food is just a part of our culture. So you can't speak of, when you're speaking of Iranian music, literature, poetry, art, food comes right in there with it. You can't separate any of those. So I grew up in a household where cooking was happening all the time. It wasn't that it was something special, it was that it was just happening. We mostly ate at home, whether it was in Iran and then in Italy or Canada. Going out was for something very special. It wasn't something that happened often. We didn't order out as everyone does these days. So all those scents and sounds and spices and mounds of fresh herbs were being chopped and, you know, going on around me all the time. I also came from a family, I would say like many Iranians, where as a child and as a young person, I wasn't invited into the kitchen to cook because I knew my place, and it wasn't like they wanted me in there because I would most likely do something incorrectly anyways. But it wasn't a thing of, oh, let me come and show you how to make this stew. No, it was tend to your studies, do what you need to do. And I think it was just assumed when it was time, all of that would seep in somehow. And it did. And I was curious about it. So I embraced it once I left home. And I always say, when I left my family home for Los Angeles, within a week, I found myself hungry. And this wasn't like an actual hunger, but it was a hunger for home, for my family, and for that kitchen table that meant so much for us, to me and to all of us. So right away, I called up my mother and started asking for recipes. And we all know how that goes. There isn't a recipe, right? All those recipes were followed through with stories. So that's my connection to cooking at a young age or being surrounded by it.
Wonderful. Thank you so much. And I appreciate what you say about mothers. I have that myself. Brian, what about you?
Yeah. So I should start by saying that, you know, so much of my body of work has been pushing back against these very reductive ways that people imagine Black food. And what I found is that, you know, when people hear Black food, what they think, or if they hear African-American cuisine, what people often are imagining are one of two things. The antebellum survival foods upon which many enslaved Africans had to rely, or the kind of big flavored meats and overcooked vegetables and sugary desserts that one might find at a soul food restaurant. And, you know, we can complicate that first narrative because the institution of slavery wasn't a monolith. And before, you know, during the antebellum period, there were free Blacks in this landmass that we call the U.S. or whatever. So that's just historically inaccurate to kind of reduce it to just actually the way that people kind of pejoratively will, you know, talk about our food when they're referring to that whole history is slave food. So why would I eat Black food? That's just slave food. Or, oh, that soul food is just killing us. So always this kind of vilification and oversimplification of African-American cuisine, which I argue is, you know, the first modern global fusion cuisine. When you think about the ingredients that traveled from West and Central Africa to the New World and how they intermingled with the indigenous crops and flavor profiles and cooking techniques of this land. And then obviously the influence of European cooking practices and, you know, food traditions. But in terms of like what one of the big thrusts for me doing this work is because I grew up in a family where the diversity and complexity of Black food was just a matter of fact. It was just the way that we lived and the way that we ate. And, you know, when we talk about the kind of traditional foundational foods of African-American cuisine, we're talking about dark leafy greens like collards and mustards and turnips and kale and dandelions and things like okra and sugar snap peas and pole beans and black-eyed peas. These are all what I think, you know, most allopathic trained Western physicians or nutritionists or dietitian would say that we should all be eating these type of, you know, whole, you know, local seasonal good food. And I say that because the food that my family ate was as local as our backyard garden. We always ate what was in season. And often we would literally harvest the food before we had our meal. And that ethos came, you know, with my grandparents when they migrated from the rural South to the urban South, as many Black folks did. So when they came to Memphis, where I grew up, they brought with them the agrarian knowledge, the survival tools, the desire to grow their own food. And my paternal grandfather would often say to me, you know, if you rely on others to feed you, when they decide that they don't want to, then you'll starve. And he was really trying to, you know, just help me understand the importance of self reliance and self-determination, specifically in regard to food. But in terms of my kind of love of cooking It actually came from spending time with my maternal grandmother, because she was an amazing cook, and she had, you know, a kitchen garden as well as her mini orchard with peach trees and pear trees and nectarine trees in her backyard, apple trees. But the I would say the most prominent food memory when I think about spending time with her in the kitchen was the cupboard that she had that was about 7 feet tall and a foot deep, each shelf crowded with glass jars full of preserves, pickled pears, peaches, carrots, green beans, figs, blackberry jam, sauerkraut, and her not to be forgotten chow chow, which is a Southern relish that is cooked and served along with dark leafy greens. It's usually peppers, onions, chopped finely and cooked for about 3 or 4 hours until it forms this really rich relish. So yeah, Madea's cupboard is my favorite and most consistent food memory from my childhood.
Can only imagine as a kid what that must have felt like to just be checking through that cupboard and seeing what was there. It's lovely. Andrea, what about you in terms of your own growing up in your food traditions and your family?
Well, there are a lot. I was chubby as a kid in a developed country, which meant that, you know, we were fortunate to be well fed. And when my family left Vietnam in 1975, and we came to the United States, to Southern California, actually Camp Pendleton, so the Library Foundation's, you know, audience can understand how close that was to LA. And my mother thought that she would come here to the United States and open a restaurant. So she brought along with her a small collection of recipes written in an orange notebook that I own today. And those recipes were her recipes that she thought, you know, I don't know what's going to be available in America, but I'm going to be sure that we can have Vietnamese food. And there are going to be plenty of other Vietnamese refugees who want to eat this food too. Well, that didn't happen. She didn't have a restaurant, but she had a family of seven to feed. And so from a very young age, she noticed that I was interested in food. I liked to eat it and I seemed dexterous enough. And so she got me doing things like making rice first thing. And she was disciplined. She wasn't the type of person that didn't have recipes. She had, you know, certain spoons and bowls that she used. She had measurements that she would go back between metric and imperial. She used a scale and she had written down recipes, and she would make me wash rice and count out how many times I do it and have to count it out loud. If she didn't hear me, she'd say, "I didn't hear you." And it was like this awful thing for this, you know, 10-year-old kid, but I learned how to make rice. And if I flubbed on occasion, well, you know, I had to kind of apologize to my family. And it was awful at the time, but it taught me a great deal of discipline. And we would have these wonderful feasts with other Vietnamese refugees who had come to the area. And just last week, when I was in Southern California visiting my parents, I went to Dana Point, which is very close to San Clemente. And I remembered seeing families there gathering on Thanksgiving, of how my family used to also gather with our friends with like tons of food. And we'd sit there on the grass and we'd, you know, be eating all this Vietnamese food that everybody brought something or other. And it was really fun. And for me, you know, that was, you know, our ability to be not just Vietnamese in America, but part of my identity as a Vietnamese American. Mm. And Southern California plays such a huge role in that, which is why I'm just delighted to be here with the LA Library Foundation too. But I think, you know, we all have memories, and I write my books based on a lot of memories from, you know, the first time I learned how to cook rice to like the stacks of wonton skins that my mother made me, you know, fill for dumplings. And so, you know, all of that stuff when I was growing up shaped my understanding of what food is. It's certain level of discipline, and it's also a craft. And also you can make mistakes and you just eat your boo-boos and keep going.
I like that philosophy a lot. I mean, I use that pretty much all the time. You know, it's interesting in this last thing that you have all talked about, you know, there is a theme of when you're an immigrant or you're brought to this country, the idea of diaspora and displacement is a huge theme in all of your work. I'd love you to talk a little bit more about Black food and the amazing way that you organized that book and your intention behind that book.
Sure. Well, so this is my latest book project, Black Food. And while recipes are a through line, it isn't just a cookbook. I hate kind of, well, I understand why it's marketed that way, but I want to be clear that this is so much more than a cookbook, because there are riveting essays by scholars, journalists, activists working around food issues globally. There are, you know, creative pieces, poetry, a list of questions that we might want to ponder in terms of our own self-care, prescriptions for better health, like a healing okra bath. Because largely inspired by my residency at the Museum of the African Diaspora since 2015, there's a through line of fine art in the book. And I either commission or license pieces from different artists to open up each chapter. I chose images that really encapsulates the energy and the content within. So this book makes a great holiday gift, I must say. but, you know, this is the book that I feel like my whole body of work prepared me to write. I've been making the same argument over and over since my first book, Grub, Ideas for an Urban Organic Kitchen. I love that people, you know, are really excited about the collage-like nature of this book and how it brings so many different elements to move us. You know, when we think about Black food, I definitely want people to be thinking beyond just physical, you know, nourishment, but thinking about the multiple ways that we can be fed spiritually, intellectually. And I want to share a quote, because I just want to give you a sense of kind of the thrust behind this project. And just to put it in context, you know, I've been thinking about this book since 2015, because when we had our first program that I curated at MOAD, it was a panel discussion, Black Women, Food and Power, where we talked about the historical and contemporary role of Black women in the production and distribution and consumption of food and food knowledge, because we had a number of scholars on the panel. And, you know, the fact that we had people flying in from the East Coast, I knew immediately that this was a special program that we were doing in our small but mighty museum in San Francisco. And there was a literal hunger for this type of programming. So fast forward to 2020 and, you know, on the heels of the uprisings post state murders of Breonna Taylor and George Floyd, I felt like this was the moment. And I must say that, you know, it was that, but it was also the revelation of a lot of racism within food media. And, you know, some of the legacy food media companies were called out. Some of the publishing houses were being taken to task for their failure to support their BIPOC authors. And I knew that this book, it was time for us to do this book. So anyway, I just want to share the quote that I sent to the more than 100 potential contributors who offered something to the book. There are over 100 contributors. And so it reads, "When I think about Black food, I keep coming back to Toni Morrison's quote, 'The function of racism is distraction. It keeps you explaining over and over again your reason for being,' end quote. While this book will acknowledge the historical and contemporary ways in which our people have been marginalized, exploited, and erased, the main focus of this project is our agency, creation, and empowerment. What emerges when we aren't distracted by racism? How are we empowered? What are the ways our humanity is displayed? What are we curious about? What brings us joy?" And I really wanted to create a book that had, you know, no concern for the white gaze. I wanted this to be a conversation that these brilliant chefs and authors and artists and scholars and grassroots activists and poets, I wanted to be a conversation that we had with each other. And then we invited the world to listen in and, you know, experience Black food in its multiple ways. And I'm really excited about the fact that people have been coming in to the book where it makes sense. Some people have been clear, like, look, I don't cook a lot, but I would love to learn more about the history and culture of Black food. I'm excited that over a dozen professors have emailed me since the publication and let me know that they're including it on their spring syllabus for, you know, ethnic studies courses, food studies programs, history programs. But then there are people who are really into the recipes. Other people see it as a coffee table book because of the beautiful imagery in the cover. And so there's a little bit of something in this book for everyone.
It's a beautiful book. I think I told you when I opened, I first saw it, I just started crying because it's just beautiful and so rich. But I think what you're talking about is like the motivation for writing a cookbook. And I think that's something I can really think about with you guys is like, it book is a really big commitment, you know, an act of writing is hard to commit to that and to actually tell stories. And I'd love to explore that a little bit more. Maybe Naz, you can talk a little bit about the experience of writing your book and sort of what inspired you to do it. You started off with this beautiful story of what the bottom of the pot actually means. And I'm wondering if you could sort of delve into that since it sort of speaks a little bit to what Bryant's talking about in terms of memory and culture.
Sure. So bottom of the pot is literally the word for the meaning of tadlig in Persian, which is the crispy bottom of the pot, which everyone loves and wants and fights over. I have seen it referred to elsewhere as scorched rice. I would say as Iranians, we can't refer to this as scorched rice. Scorched will not do. It's golden, it's crisp, but it is not scorched. And it's the title of my book. I really had no intention of ever writing a book or a cookbook. I don't come from the food world. I started a blog maybe 7 years ago. I don't remember. It's now defunct. But and it was really just for my own personal pleasure of sharing my recipes and stories with friends and family. I'm like, technology is not my thing. So it was just literally simple blogger, something that I could do very simply. And it was for my friends and family. But very quickly, I found that as soon as I started making this food and I reached for that little jar of saffron that my mother lovingly grinds for me in Canada, the saffron that she got from Iran in a suitcase, somebody brought it over and sends to me in a little pill bottle sometimes. Once all these senses got going, it brought back a whole host of memories of living in Iran as a young child, the revolution, immigration, all of it started coming back. So once again, I found that it wasn't just the recipes for me, it was the stories that went along with the recipes. And I couldn't just post a recipe if I wasn't giving you, and what we call context now, but I still like the story behind the recipe, my story behind the recipe. And once that got going, the blog got some attention, and then I was approached to write a book, and I said no. I typically just say no to everything that comes my way first. I didn't know anything about book writing, and my mother is a very, very accomplished writer, and I knew that this would be a very serious undertaking for myself if I decided to do it. So I wasn't just going to do it haphazardly just for the sake of writing a book. So I sat on it for about a year and I kept writing for the blog and making more food and writing recipes. And slowly I found that I had more recipes to share and I had more stories to share. And I felt a little more confident about writing the book. I have two children, two actual live children. I call the book my third child. It really, when they say it's like giving birth, it's like giving birth. I went gray. Pre-COVID, I went gray with the book. And it took over every part of my life. My family was great in that they gave up, you know, holidays, anniversaries, whatnot, just so I could get a little more time to write. Our friends were great in that they took the kids so I could get a little more time to write. So I'm indebted to my village far and near. I'm indebted to my family in Iran. On WhatsApp, I would ask them questions about, you know, this dish and that ingredient. And we, that was a chance for us to connect again. And so I, you know, the cookbook writing process was not an easy one for me. It really did take everything that I had to write this book and to share these stories. Also because the stories are very personal to me. And I don't like to put my life out there on social media and whatnot. I admire people that do. It's just not something I'm comfortable with. So to share myself this way in the cookbook was something challenging, but ultimately one of the best things I've done. And they say, like pregnancy, you forget and you might want to do it again. I don't know if I'm quite there, but maybe.
Well, your writing is so beautiful. I said this to you before, but there are a number of times when I was reading your book where I was really very moved by the way you write. Beautiful crafting. And then Andrea, I wanted to just connect with you about how many books you've written. I mean, and you have created so many books on different individual topics. How do you, what drives your work? What makes you get up in the morning and write these books?
Part of it is fear of not meeting deadlines. But the other thing, overarching thing that I write for is the motivation to make a point. I think Bryant touched upon that in every single one of his books. When I open them up, I see that he is out. He's on a mission. You know, Naz's narrative in her books tell the story of her family leaving Iran, going to Europe through Canada, and here she is in LA. Mm-hmm. Black Food tells beautiful stories throughout, and every single chapter opens up with questions, you know, that intrigue us, and artwork that pull us in, and recipes that have beautiful stories behind them. So when I conceive of a book project, I need to have a reason to write. I need to have a motivation. I need to contribute something to the table, to the conversation. Otherwise, that is not going to pull me through from the beginning of writing a proposal to the end of publicizing the book and helping it sell. So with my first book, Into the Vietnamese Kitchen, it was the thing of, I wanted to tell the story of how Vietnamese people preserve their identity through food here in America. Mm. How my family did it, you know, to also represent Vietnamese food as food that people can make in America. It's not some exotic, distant thing. You don't need to wear a conical hat to be wearing. You don't need to travel and obtain a bunch of ingredients. And when I got to my next book, such as Asian Dumplings or an Asian Tofu, I saw those two specific foods as ways to explain to people what Asia is, and that Asia is this vast territory, and that if you just take a look at dumplings, you will connect all the dots to these people coming together through a little stuffed morsel. With tofu, there was all of this misinformation about what tofu is and what tofu can be. You know, tofu is not a food of deprivation. It's a food for celebration. And that's what that book is about, the story of tofu in Asia and also coming here to the United States. And then I just thought I would attack, you know, the iconic gateway foods of Vietnam with the Banh Mi Handbook and Pho. And, you know, I was with Banh Mi, I thought, there are hamburger books. Ah, Bryant. So I thought, there are hamburger books. Why can't there be a Banh Mi book? Because it's such a customizable food. And with Pho, I got to tell you, I thought I had nothing to say about that noodle soup. But both my publisher and people who have taken cooking classes with me said, you have something to say. And once I started investigating and researching the history of pho, I realized it's been part of protest poetry. It's been part of espionage. It's also part of the beautiful story of Vietnam in the 20th and now 21st century, of Vietnamese people leaving and seeding pho culture somewhere else as they seeded Vietnamese culture somewhere else. of Vietnamese people in Vietnam saying, we're kind of tired of pho as it is. So can we make a pho-ish cocktail? And they do, and it tastes good.
What?
You know, and so Vietnamese food is this evolving thing. My current project, and you know, with Vietnamese food any day, it was this thing of like, shoot, all the ingredients that you can make, like really fabulous Vietnamese food, are now available at a regular supermarket, because supermarkets now are so much better stocked than before. When my family came to the United States in 1975, there was no fish sauce. We had yucky soy sauce, you know, jasmine rice from Thailand wasn't available. You know, we got by, but nowadays I can go into, you know, a Western mainstream supermarket and find all kinds of things. And also thanks to like gluten-free diets, because now you can get beautiful brown rice cappellini from Italy that you can substitute for boon rice noodles, those little round rice noodles that people eat in the salad bowls. And so Vietnamese Food Any Day is about the fact that this cuisine that seems so mysterious to people can be doable with ingredients at hand, and it doesn't need to be a project. So if people are making, you know, sheet pan, like roasting off sheet pan chicken dinners, they can also make, you know, beautiful Vietnamese food anytime they want, any day they want. And it should be there and part of their repertoire. And the beautiful thing about that book is that during the pandemic, people have been cooking through that book as a way to learn about Vietnamese culture. So I always think that, you know, you can cook your own food, but cook other people's foods too. I never understood pheasant jeon until I made Naz's recipe. And then she said, I could freeze it, you know? And then in Brian's book, Vegetable Kingdom, there's like this pickled mustard greens recipe that is totally cross-cultural, you know, that speaks to his identity and his experiences. And I can learn about him. And so it's like, this is what cookbooks is about. They're about, you know, and dive in and cook and read.
I love that. And it's funny, I know in Brian, in your book, there's a quote from Tao Li Goff. I can't figure out how to say his name, but it's, what is food but an archive of desires? And I thought about like how we share in those desires. Brian, what recipes would you recommend, or in terms of like when you bring your people together? This is my own selfish thing, because I love to bring people together, and I've worked with two of you on my book. But when you think about the kind of food that you'd like to bring people together around, what is your go-to kind of food?
Well, before I answer that question, I just want to kind of touch on a point that Naz made earlier. And I think we could probably all relate to this, but the process of making a cookbook is grueling. Well, let me just speak for myself. It is grueling, protracted, isolating, and I'm not going to get myself in trouble and use that kind of birthing analogy. I've tried that before, but I'm like, nope, shut up. Don't do that. You can use another analogy, but I do feel like if I could recall just how intense writing my prior book was when I'm thinking about writing a new one, I probably would not write a new book. But it was interesting because I, you know, up until probably Vegetable Kingdom, I just felt like I was in a position where, you know, cookbooks, writing cookbooks were actually like outside of the speaking engagements, that was one of the kind of main anchors in terms of like the income I was bringing in. And I just got to a point where it started to feel, I didn't feel like I was, I mean, I guess there are a couple things that I think about. One, if I had the kind of financial security back 10 years ago, I probably wouldn't have written any more books, because I'm like, I'm good. I don't need to do this. And so maybe we wouldn't have seen this unfolding body of work. But I also just, I don't want to ever be in a position where I'm writing a book and I don't feel like this burning desire. Like, I think it was Toni Morrison who said that, you know, write the book that you want to see in the world. And that's the only way that I encourage people to engage in the book creation process, because you do need something that's going to like anchor you and keep you motivated throughout that. And so I'm done writing books. Black Food is actually my last book, and I'm retiring from you know, authoring books, and very excited about putting a lot of energy into learning how to be a good publisher now. But to answer your question, in terms of what dish I might bring to gatherings, someone had actually mentioned something about this, the kind of reimagining of a lot of African-American cuisine as, you know, vegan or plant-based, does that help moving in a progressive direction? And I would argue that these traditions have been a part of African-American and other African diaspora cuisines before now, in the moment where African-Americans or Black, I don't know, I need to like look further into statistics. I don't know if it's African-Americans or just Black people kind of looking at generally people of African descent in America, but Black folks here are the highest, are the fastest growing population of vegans in the United States. And I think about that a lot, especially in terms of, you know, when we were shopping, my literary agent and I were shopping my second book, Vegan Soul Kitchen. And we got like 10 rejections. Like we shopped it to 12 publishers and 10 of them said no. And the response, what their reasoning was they felt like, well, I mean, look, some of them were just straight up like offensive, like this is oxymoronic, vegan, Black people, Black people even eat vegetables, you know, in so many words. I was hearing these type of offensive responses from some of these publishing houses. But, you know, all that to say is that I often think about how like people like Nas, Andrea, me, you, Leslie, the people who are on the ground doing the work in communities, a part of the culture, I think it's important for us to trust ourselves and know that when we have something important to say, even if we don't get like the immediate thumbs up from the multinational publishing companies, we have to trust that vision. And that was really a lesson for me in like understanding that people like us, we are aware of the current cultural zeitgeist. We are, you know, kind of tracking and aware of like the emerging zeitgeist, especially when you think about writing a book. It's not like, you know, the book is coming out immediately. You sign a contract, may take you a year to write it, and then a year for production. And so, you know, I just think that we have to trust ourselves. But this is a very circuitous
way to say it. Now you brought up a whole new thing, which is, I guess this idea of books, which again, having been in publishing and experienced both sides of it, it is really the idea that you trust yourself to create something that's your vision is really meaningful. And it is hard because sometimes you're out there and people don't see your vision. And so you have to find a way to get it done. And I know I self-funded for Feed Your People, and then it came out and everyone said, well, that's a really good idea. But you know, when you're out there making that thing that you feel you're compelled to make, and this goes back to what you said, Andrea, it's like, it's the thing that you want to see. It's the reason that it's the thing you want to read that you don't see that makes it really compelling and exciting. And sort of what you said, Nas, it's like, you know, it's hard and it's lonely. So when you do it and you finish it, it's, you know, it's in a pretty intense process.
So to finish, I'd make the vegan blueberry cheesecake from Black Food. That would be the thing that I would bring to that. That's the thing that I'm, the dish I'm bringing to all the family gatherings this holiday season. So.
Great. How about you, Andrea?
Oh gosh. There are these little, that's the holiday season. There are these puff pastry puffs that we make, pâté chaud, and in Vietnamese food any day, the filling is vegetarian. It's a mushroom filling, and it's just wonderful. You can just prepare them, freeze these logs, slice them up, bake them up, and then you're ready to go. And you can, it's a totally, you know, French influenced thing. When you go to Vietnam, they're round shaped. Also at Vietnamese delis, they're rounds, but they're kind of, you know, dense. You're gonna sit in your stomach, you're gonna eat a whole big one. And so pâté chauds are, in my family, now reduced to a cocktail snack to be enjoyed with wine and even tea if you like. But I grew up actually eating them for breakfast because my mom would make puff pastry from scratch. But you can cheat by all means with store-bought. And I actually favor Trader Joe's puff pastry, which is a seasonal item that I just want to put out there that is available now.
That's a good one. How about you, Naz?
Well, when you write a book called Bottom of the Pot, everyone expects you to bring bottom of the pot. So it has to be some type of tahdig rice dish, but one that I love for the holidays, and I think it's like a real showstopper, but it's really not that difficult to make, is a dish called tahin, which is like tadik, but tahin means layered on the bottom. And it's a rice dish that will make the crispy rice, but you make it in the oven and in a Pyrex dish. And the beauty of that is that if you make it in a Pyrex dish, you can cheat and look under and see if it's crisping, if it's burning. It's not this whole mental thing of, I don't know, we'll just wait. When I flip the thing, if it turns out, it turns out. And if it doesn't, please forgive me, right? So tahin, my recipe in the book has chicken layered in between, but you can make a vegetarian with eggplant or mushrooms or spinach. And we top it with this beautiful topping of barberries, gently sauteed barberries, which are the little red ruby jeweled berries, with a little bit of sugar to balance out the tartness, and maybe some chopped pistachios. And that and a side of yogurt and some fresh herbs is the perfect meal, but it's also really beautiful for the holidays with all the colors going on as well. I wanted to touch on one thing that Brian said about trusting yourself. And I think as minorities as well, it's, at least I'll speak for myself, embedded in me not to trust myself, that maybe someone else knows better, or someone else always will know better, that maybe I'm wrong. And I found this early on in the process, not so much of writing my book, but when I was like first submitting recipes elsewhere and writing for publications, that there was a fear of maybe I really didn't know what I was talking about, the thing that I really did know what I was talking about. But there was always this doubt that maybe they do know better. And to anyone out there who's in the process, be it in the food world or elsewhere, stop that. Trust yourself, do your research. You have to be on top of it. Do all your research, contact all the experts, but know that when you know something about your culture and your background, it's true. And no one can tell you otherwise.
And I just want to add to that and give this piece of advice for any budding writers or potential authors. Fake it till you make it. You know, I used to judge, harshly judge, you know, my prior book as soon as I come out with a new one. And I'm just looking at it like, oh my God, I hate that book. I don't want to see it. The recipes suck, or I could have done this better. And I had to get over that kind of overly critical way in which I was looking at the work. And now the way I frame it is I've been practicing in public. And in fact, if I don't feel embarrassed about the prior, you know, book that I've written, once I come out with a new one, I don't think I've grown. Like I think ideally, in writing a new book, my craft should be getting stronger. I should be, you know, a better writer. I should just understand the internal logic of bookmaking better. And so I just wanted to kind of share this personal journey that I've had, where I no longer look at my, you know, body of work with contempt, but actually celebrate it and see it just kind of preparing me for the next project. And like I said, I feel like all the other books really prepared me to put together this masterpiece that is Black Food, which is not my book. It's a collective of people that came together to create the book. But I felt like I was prepared to be a good leader to move us to our finish line.
Yeah, and you know, it doesn't matter, like, to write about food, you just, it requires passion on one level, but it also requires a fun thing that I call obsession. And it's what, you know, drives you, and it's exciting, and it is grueling. I think that people think of recipes nowadays, because there are so many recipes that are available online and for free, that what is presented in a book, in bound, in something that is physical and tangible, is easy, just as easy as what's available online, but it is not. They are different animals. And vegetables for you, Brian. and the thing is that, you know, we go through a lot to make these recipes so that they work for home cooks, and to make them look beautiful and attractive in a publication, and, you know, so, and have interesting ideas, Leslie, like big batches. And I think imposter syndrome, which I have long suffered because in Vietnamese culture, there's always this thing of that someone is going to come up to you and say the words không đúng, which means that's not correct. It's not good enough. And it's this thing of like, not just insulting you, but perhaps like your parents and ancestors, and it just goes way, way back. And you're just sitting there going, I will never, ever be able to be right about anything. But it is this practice and this maturity where you gain confidence. And there are times when I look back at my earlier works and I say, what did you say to do in that recipe? Did you forget you mentioned that? And then I read and go, oh, you did. All right, you covered your butt. That's okay. That's good. You did a good job. And so it's like, you know, self-flagellation on one hand. And then it's like, oh my gosh, you know, I'm all right. And I think that we all go through that in writing, and whether it's professional or as a casual thing if you're blogging. But, you know, it's practice, like Brian said. And it is birthing. I have no children, but I do consider my books as my babies.
Yes, I think, you know, I've worked with a lot of authors as an editor, and I know, Bryant, you're now going into being a publisher, which is really about this new cultivating a lot of writers. What do you see as the future of Four Color Butte books? I'd love to hear more about that publishing effort.
Sure. You know, for me, being a publisher now, I think simply formalizing what I've done since I started publishing books, and that's supporting budding authors, helping people navigate the publishing world. I felt fortunate to have these brilliant mentors who were there for me and guided me in the early phase of my career, like Francis Moore LePay, who wrote Died for a Small Planet, John Robbins, who wrote Died for a New America. And so I really just see myself paying it forward. And, you know, we pitched the imprint, and this has been a vision that my literary agent and I have long had in terms of me having my own publishing imprint. But, you know, what I realized is that I was doing this thing, my mom calls it like blocking your blessings, where I was putting all these unnecessary barriers in front of me achieving that goal. You know, it was always like, well, when I get this many followers, or, you know, this many books have been published, or I feel like I'm at this stature in my career, that's when I'm going to be ready. And, you know, advice I want to share, go for it. Don't wait. You know, if you have a great idea and you feel like it's feasible for you to, you know, actually implement it, just go for it. Don't keep pushing things off. And so I'm glad that we made the pitch in 2020. And I mean, we're rolling. We have acquired about 4 books already. We're on the cusp of acquiring, I hope, 2 more. And, you know, cookbooks, because that's my wheelhouse, we will be building the foundation of the imprint with cookbooks and food related books. But eventually, as the imprint grows, we'll be publishing books that, you know, whatever I'm interested in, from poetry to prescriptive nonfiction to personal development and self-help. So very excited about that. But I just wanted to also say that publishing books is simply one part of what we'll be doing at Four Color Books. There's the action arm, as I describe it, where we are going to be actually putting teeth into helping to ensure that we can play a role in diversifying food media. So we're currently planning a Black Food Summit at MOAD, the Museum of the African Diaspora in San Francisco, where we'll be gathering people throughout the Black diaspora for skills sharing, community building, and networking. We're amassing databases of BIPOC art directors and food photographers and food stylists and prop stylists, because I can't tell you how many times I've heard the excuse, well, we looked for an Asian food photographer, but we couldn't find one. Or we tried to get a Black, you know, prop stylist, but there just aren't any. And so there are, you know, BIPOC folks doing these quote unquote below the line jobs in food media. And we need to ensure that there are more pipelines and mentoring opportunities and more pathways to ensure that we continue to see this field of food media diversified. And I really see Black Four Color playing a role in helping to actually affect change in that way.
It's just really exciting. Exciting the opportunities that are becoming available. I also wanted to open it up to Andrea and to Naz to tell me what are the new projects you guys have on the horizon.
I'm currently I'm developing recipes for the New York Times cooking section, and we have a really exciting piece coming out in print and online tomorrow about Yaldo, Shab Yaldo, which is the Iranian celebration of the winter solstice. And there will be recipes, and they'll be really pomegranate oriented because they're symbolic for the solstice for us. So I'm just, that's what I'm currently working on. I have other things going on here and it's a matter of just grabbing them and making myself really do it. I'm like Andrea, I need a deadline. Otherwise, woo, I'll go another 10 years and these things will be floating around here. So I just need someone to grab me by the arm and sit me down and make me do it. So hopefully, you know, it'll all come to fruition.
That sounds like a wonderful piece, beautiful piece. And you have some people here who might help you do that. Bring it. I might give you a call tomorrow and be like, come on.
That's what I need. I just need people to be tough. I need like tough love. I don't respond to sweetness. I need straight up tough love.
I'm very surprised, Naz. You're like a super determined person. I have a manuscript due in early January to my editor at 10 Speed Press for a vegetable-centric Vietnamese cookbook. And it's mostly vegetarian and vegan. And I've been having a blast really putting the recipes together and my recipe testers who are mostly not vegetarian people were omnivores, but they're super excited about the recipes. And that book will be out in early 2023. I'm also working on a podcast project called Everything Cookbooks that'll launch early next year with three other veteran cookbook authors. And so we've been putting together shows for that and brainstorming. It's really, really exciting to hear and share some of this stuff that we've been talking about in terms of the difficulties of writing a cookbook. You know, there are all these issues such as, you know, that we've talked about recently. The New York Times ran a story on plagiarism this week that was quite illuminating in terms of issues such as how Black cooks were, you know, had their ideas as totally dismissed and erased from cookbooks for, you know, centuries because they just were excluded. They didn't count, you know, and so our body of what we know as American cookbooks lacks the voice of so many of the creators of the foods that we appreciate. And so, you know, there are all of these issues that are related to cookbooks, and I think that we could probably keep talking all night.
It just means we have to have another conversation.
Yes. Yes.
So we are getting to the end of our time here, but I did want to also mention that the library store has created boxes for each one that goes along with each one of your books. And so for people who are interested in getting a beautiful gift for people, I highly recommend the books. And of course, there are these beautiful spice boxes that were put together by Spice Station. And there's one for Andrea's book and one for Naz's and one for Brian's and one for mine. So I think that's about all the time we have. I have really appreciated your participation in this and your kindness and your work. Love your work. And I think maybe we'll have Jessica come back in and close this out. Jessica, oh, there she is.
Thank you so much, each of you, Naz and Andrea and Brian, and you, Leslie, thank you. For putting this together and getting all these wonderful people. And yes, thank you, audience, for being here this evening. This will be our last program for the season. We will have programs in January, but this has been a beautiful program to end our season with. And I want to thank all of you for being here and thank the audience for being here. And yes, and I want to thank also, Lee and Christine at the library store, who, along with Spice Station, put these beautiful boxes together. And please happy holidays to all, whatever holiday that you do celebrate. And yes, go and purchase these extraordinary books and these spices and cook away and fill your bellies for the holidays. And thank you all so much for being here. It's a great pleasure. And I'm honored that you're all here. So thank you all. And thank you all for tuning in this evening. Good night.
Aloud is made possible by the Hearst Foundation, the Hollywood Foreign Press Association, the Los Angeles County Department of Arts and Culture, Errant Fox, City National Bank, the Los Angeles Public Library, and additional generous supporters of the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. To support programs like this, become a member at lfla.org.